We are traveling back to the Cold War era and the People Machine, the origins of using computing technology to predict human behavior. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And mind you, this was decades, decades before Facebook, before Google, before Cambridge Analytica, the scandal mining Facebook data from millions of people worldwide, allegedly using it for political campaigns. The social scientists at Simulmatics in the 60s were the ancestors of targeted ads, laying groundwork for the predictive analytics field today. This is an industry expected to top $12 billion soon. So is human behavior predictable? Can equations upend our democratic processes? We're at 800-642-1234. Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University, a staff writer at The New Yorker, host of the podcast The Last Archive, and her new book is called If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Jill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So you unearthed about 200 boxes at the MIT archive in the papers of Ithiel de Sola Poole. What were you looking for in these boxes from this man, this quantitative behavioral scientist?
Well, I had an assignment for The New Yorker where I'm a staff writer to write a history of the polling industry. This was 2015, and remember, the polls seemed to be going crazy. It was, you know, right around the time when Donald Trump had declared his bid for the Republican nomination. And so my assignment was to sort of explain where polls come from and how they've changed over time. And at a certain point, I realized that polls had taken a big turn toward what we would call data science. Right, like why bother to call people up and ask them an hour's worth of questions when you can just figure out what they believe by tracking them online?
Yeah.
And so I came across an obscure reference to this company called Simulmatics, which brought me to Poole's papers. And I don't know, the whole thing kind of cascaded out of those archival boxes to me with its deep resonance with our day.
And so you're looking through these boxes, and this Poole, he worked on Adlai Stevenson's campaign in 56, went on to found this company, Simulmatics, with a character named Ed Greenfield in 1959. What were you noticing here about this corporation? What struck you?
The thing that really grabbed my attention was the stock offering. The company went public in 1961. And so the stock offering was in the archives of Poole's papers. He was a political scientist, quite a brilliant political scientist at MIT. And this stock offering, you know, it's this quaint sort of ancient looking document from the 60s. But, you know, the mission statement is the company proposes to engage in the use of computer technology to estimate probable human behavior. And I don't know, it just kind of knocked me off my chair that in 1961. Like, that's the mission statement of most companies today, right? Like, that's how you're making your money. You're guessing what people are going to do so that you can sell them stuff.
So Simulmatics, it's the brainchild of this ad exec, Ed Greenfield, like a character out of Mad Men, as you describe him, puts together this collection of men with different specialties in math and computer science, in political science. What was Ed's vision?
So he was a very charismatic ad guy, just in that Mad Men way. He also, you know, kind of loved to collect people. You know, we all know that person who knows everyone. That was Greenfield. Poole's theory of 6 degrees of separation came out of his knowledge of Greenfield. He was just that guy that knows everyone. He was a very committed liberal Democrat, which was unusual in the advertising world, right? These big ad agencies on Madison Avenue, they worked for big businesses. Big businesses tended to be Republican, right? The Republicans were then the party of business, somewhat less so now. Democrats, the party of labor. But what was dividing between them was kind of the question of civil rights. Greenfield was a big advocate of civil rights. He wanted Democrats to take a stronger position on civil rights. So although he worked for Stevenson's campaign in 56 with what he called his social science division, a bunch of quantitative political scientists, including Poole, who helped him gather data for the Stevenson campaign, what he was really trying to do, kind of just politically, was push the Democrats to take a stronger position on civil rights. And he was enormously frustrated, as were so many liberals, white liberals, and of course, above all, Black Americans who were part of the civil rights movement, so frustrated with the Democrats for kind of dragging their feet, and much worse than dragging their feet on civil rights in the 1950s.
We're talking with Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard. Her new book traces the history of the first political data science company during the 50s and 60s, the Simulmatics Corporation. Have you heard this story about the history of polling and election data and making predictions? What do you think? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. So Simulmatics starts working with the Democratic National Committee ahead of the 1960 election of John F. Kennedy. What were they doing with this client? What was the aim here?
So they had come up with, if you think about, you know, how exciting it was to have computers for the first time to do the kind of high-speed calculations computers were able to do, people who are studying human behavior were trying to think of ways to use that tool to do mathematical modeling. So in order to predict human behavior the way they could predict, you know, they could do flight simulation in the 50s, right? So targeting missiles or training pilots, so thinking about really important for the arms race to do flight simulation, being able to simulate the movement of objects through space. These behavioral scientists wanted to simulate human behavior. But if you think about it, the most obvious place to do that is with political behavior, because it generates its own data, right? It just as right now, people are going to the polls. Every time you cast a vote, you're adding to this massive
aggregation of data. It's accruing right now.
And then it's accruing right now, we hope. And, you know, there's, on top of that, that's layered on top of the census data, which breaks down populations in quite minute segments. We also have public opinion polling data. So Greenfield and this team of people got the idea that they could compile, they could aggregate all that data, you know, what we would call a big data project. They called it a massive data project. It was really probably the largest social science research project up to that point. Put together all that data, derive a mathematical model, and simulate the election. But the point of all of this work was to convince the Democratic Party that Black votes mattered, because pollsters hadn't really accounted for the Black electorate. And Simulmatics wanted to try to demonstrate that Black votes in northern swing states could win the election for the Democratic candidate if the Democratic candidate would take a strong position on civil rights. So these guys built what they called a people machine. It divided the electorate into 480 possible voter types, and then using public opinion polling data about issues, purported to be able to sort of endlessly simulate, you know, if Kennedy spoke more forthrightly about civil rights, what would voters in these states and these different demographic groups do? It could simulate those questions on any number of issues. That's the service that they were initially providing to the DNC and then later to the Kennedy campaign.
What did the Kennedy campaign make of this? Because this was computers telling them what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think that Kennedy had his own polling organization. He had hired the Lou Harris polling company. And, you know, there was a lot of pushback against polling at the time. There still is, of course, a lot of pushback against polling. And people will say, look, I mean, shouldn't the candidate just take the strong moral position, the position that the candidate believes is right about something, rather than see what the pollster tells you to do? So Simulmatics was kind of a version of that, but it was an extreme version of that, because there was so much concern at the time about automation, which is kind of the key term in the public discourse at the time for what, you know, we would kind of, we talk about automation today, but we kind of maybe more talk about robots or algorithmic or AI. We have other buzzwords, but computers were putting people out of work. And Kennedy, because the Democrats, the party of labor, had taken a strong stand on automation. He had advocated all kinds of job retraining programs, kind of certain kind of restraint on corporations from outsourcing. It made it much more difficult for him to employ a people machine.
We're talking with Harvard historian Jill Lepore. New book traces the history of the political data science company Simulmatics during the 50s and 60s. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jill Lepore here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about an overlooked history of computer predictions and this little company in the 60s that boldly used computers to predict the future. It's a conversation with Harvard historian Jill Lepore here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jill writes, long before the age of quarantine and social distancing, Simulmatics helped atomize the world. Simulmatics Corporation got its name from two words mashed together, simulation and automation, akin to the term artificial intelligence, AI, today. Do you work in predictive analytics? How accurately can you predict consumer behavior? Are algorithms getting sharper? Where are we headed? Join in 800-642-1234. Jill Lepore's book is called If Then, a nod to the statement to instruct a computer to simulate possible actions, calculate consequences, and she stays with us. Let's bring in Chris now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I felt compelled to call because in J school, journalism school, we studied the novel The 480 by Eugene Burdick. I think I've got the number right. And I, at the time we were talked about it like it was mostly speculative. Now it sounds like it was mostly grounded in reality. And I wonder if you could tell us what role Eugene Burdick played in all this, besides being the novelist.
Oh, your favorite character.
That's great. I'm super impressed that you read it in journalism school. That's really, really interesting. I'm fascinated to hear that. So Eugene Burdick, he is a tremendously exciting character to write about. He was a political theorist at the University of California, Berkeley, but he was a kind of jet-setting international intellectual celebrity of the kind. I don't know, they don't make him like that anymore, and it's probably a good thing. He was, you know, he was just incredibly sexy, like scuba diver, Rhodes Scholar, novelist.
I love how you call him the rubbery gait of a surfer.
He was, you know, tremendously athletic. So he was a kind of he had been a war hero in the Second World War for the Navy. He published fiction in The New Yorker. He kind of won awards for everything he ever did. And he's most remembered for co-writing The Ugly American, which then when it was made into a film starred Marlon Brando. So just kind of mega wattage academic fame. He was the spokesman for Ballantine Ale, which is beer. And in these hilarious ads, he's like underwater with his scuba gear. He comes up above the water and he goes back to his office to work on his next, you know, book of political theory. And the ad campaign slogan is Ballantine Ale, the search for a manlier brew. Like, it's just like the manly intellectual. Anyway, sorry, long diversion, because I could talk about Burdick forever. He was a liberal Democrat who in California worked for Ed Greenfield in the 1956 Adlai Stevenson campaign with Ithiel de Solapool, the MIT political scientist. They worked together to provide data to the Stevenson campaign, which really needed to win the California primary to secure the nomination of the Democratic Party. Burdick was really fascinated by this research and voting behavior. It was not his field. He was a theorist. He studied the math to try to kind of get up to speed on it. And then he wrote two dystopian novels about how bad it was for American politics. The first came out in 1956 and is called The Ninth Wave. It's a surfer reference. but then he wrote an indictment of Simulmatics that came out in 1964, which is what Chris was alluding to, a novel called The 480. That was, you know, it was a New York Times bestseller all through that summer, the summer of the political conventions. Looked like it was going to be a big splashy movie, and then Burdick died very suddenly playing doubles tennis in 1965. He was quite a young man. But the Burdick had been asked to work for Simulmatics. Greenfield's like, you know, we'd like to bring you on board, but he was kind of too big of a mega star to take on the project. But more, he was really concerned about it. And so he writes this kind of kooky, but also sort of great period piece in which in the 1964 presidential election, a kind of dummy candidate is brought forward to run as the Republican candidate, and his entire campaign is run by computer. And in a preface to the book, Burdick writes, like, this is the new underworld of American politics. It's going to destroy democracy. And the thing that's so strange about it is I know the guys who have built this company. He calls the company in the book Simulations Enterprises. He's like, I know this company. There's a real company. It's called the Simulmatics Corporation. They're really nice guys. They're not trying to cause any harm. In fact, they're just really trying to advance civil rights. but they're going to destroy democracy if this goes forward. So it's a really weirdly prescient and prophetic book.
We're talking with Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard, staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is called If Then, about the early days of computer prediction. And what do you think about exit polling, political surveying, and what happens to your data? Join into the conversation, 800-642-1234. Jill, as you mentioned, the company went public in 61 and had a major contract to assist the New York Times in its election coverage. What was the role there of Simulmatics?
So election night coverage, as I think everyone knows from watching it, is you know, part circus and part horse race. And you know, it's crazy. It has this whole crazy long tradition. It used to be that on election night, you would go out, you know, if you're in Madison or you're in Milwaukee, you'd go to stand outside the offices of the biggest newspaper in town, and they would sound out returns as they got them. Sometimes they'd use whistles. St. Paul used a steamship whistle from a steamship on the river. And they had like different, like almost like Morse code, like two long bleeps will mean the Republican is leading, because people wanted to follow it moment by moment. You didn't really have access to that. CBS Radio brought in this guy named Finkelstein in the 1930s, who was a mathematical savant, and he could look at the returns and conduct a mathematical projection instantly. So people, the networks and newspapers, radio and television, were always trying to figure out how to get the results projected most quickly, because the vote counting takes quite a long time, and, you know, and it's not certified for weeks and weeks and weeks, because of course we're waiting for the Electoral College to meet. But there's this fiction on election night that we know the result, because the networks had decided and newspapers decided that at a certain point in the night they could call the election.
Sounds very familiar.
Because they had projections. They're just mathematical projections. Yeah. So we have this expectation now as if like this is how it should be, but really it was just a razzle-dazzle business move on the part of first newspapers and then radio and TV. But so it was in the 1950s, radio and television in particular got out ahead of the newspapers, because television figured out how to make election night on TV kind of fun. And partly it was because they had this guy Finkelstein, but then they had a computer. So in 1952, CBS hired a UNIVAC, the first mainframe multipurpose computer, general purpose computer, had been built for the Census Bureau to count the 1950 census. They used it on election night to make projections about who was going to win. And it was the first time most people had ever seen a computer. And, you know, you hear Walter Cronkite talking about this giant electronic brain. It's very exciting. Like, they've got the thing rigged up with Christmas lights to make it blink because they don't even have it there. Anyway, it's a crazy story. But so newspapers like, God damn it, now what are we going to do? Like, we can't beat TV, we have to get a newspaper together, and we have to have careful, thoughtful, you know, fact-checked coverage. And so what newspapers decided was, although they couldn't win the race to call the election, that TV had beat them, what they could do was provide the best analysis. The TV would just be too busy, you know, chasing down Electoral College counts. And so the New York Times thought the way to do that would be to hire a data company to help them do their election night coverage. So they granted a big contract to Simulmatics, who underbid IBM, and they were going to try it out in the 1962 midterms and then formalize it in the 1964 presidential election. So Simulmatics arranges to have this, you know, remember how big these computers are? It's 62, like it's a room full of a computer to hoist it up into the editorial floors of the New Yorkers. It's like 1,000 different pieces. There are all these cables and wires. It has to be connected by modem to the AP wire service because they have to get returns. It's a super complicated thing, and it kind of just is a failure. The Simulmatics guys just really aren't able to pull off this particular project. But it is very much part of how, you know, not only newspapers, of course, but all media do their election night now, except there's a kind of DIY version today too, right, where you could try to follow that. You know, people on Twitter will be offering up their assessments. Everybody, you know, sort of every American has own data analytics firm, right?
There's a lot more noise now.
There's a lot more noise now. But it's the kind of thing that Simulmatics, like, even if you go back and read their proposal, their bid to the New York Times for the service they're going to offer, you know, they call it real-time computing analysis. Real-time computing analysis comes from the military, right? Like even the expression itself, right? The idea that that this is a service that a data company could provide to a media organization to enhance Americans' experience and understanding of an election. I think it's important that we understand that that has quite a long history, that didn't just start, you know, in 2016 or 2000, or that this goes pretty far back.
Jill Lepore's book is called If Then. It's a story of a company that pioneered a computer prediction, started in politics despite concerns that computers could manipulate voters. And Jill poses the question, think about it, can we use a giant electronic brain to win the White House? That was the huge idea of the 50s and 60s. What is it like today? Do you watch and believe in the polling today? Do you worry about big data and how it's used? Join into the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this with Jill Lepore right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Can you control people's behavior by predicting it and manipulating it? It's a question we're looking at through the historical lens here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a story of Simulmatics Corporation, which in the 60s used computers to try to predict human behavior and to try to win elections. And the scientists created what they called the people machine. Does this origin story of computer technology make you think differently about Silicon Valley today? What questions do you have about how Jill Lepore makes the connections across generations? It's 800-642-1234. Her new book is called If Then, and Harvard historian Jill Lepore stays with us. Let's bring in another call now. Ross is joining us from Middleton. Hi there, Ross.
Hi, good morning. So I'm 60 years old, and when I started voting, you would get the results that evening, and you would sort of accept the results as the way they are. Then time sort of flies, and you get into 2016, when the data seemed to indicate, the polling seemed to indicate that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and everybody felt kind of assured. And then the next day we woke up and we're like, oh my goodness, or even that night we sort of knew that something is wrong, or something didn't go according to the data. And now here we are in 2020, and the polling is sort of saying the same thing, seems to indicate it, but it seems like, in my mind, it creates a lot more anxiety. It's like in the old days, you would sort of vote, you kind of knew your neighborhood, but now it's like you sort of almost know how the voting is going to go. It creates this anxiety, and I think a lot of people are sort of saying, oh, it didn't work, and, you know, the data was wrong in 2016, so they don't have it down. And in my mind, I'm thinking like, no, it seems like they probably learned a few lessons and they're getting better at it. But to me, what I notice is just the anxiety that all this data, the polling produces in us.
Ah, predictions, the predicting complex, if you will, Ross, and the anxiety that builds. Jill, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think any of us can escape the anxiety, even if we, you know, don't closely follow the polls. It's so ubiquitous. I do think, though, you know, the projections, the methods that are used to make those projections have changed a great deal over time, and they're not infrequently wrong, right? Our elections are often very close. So, you know, 1916 is the first election where a radio broadcast was used to transmit, to kind of call the election. From the New York American, William Randolph Hearst's newspaper called it wrong. Woodrow Wilson went to bed thinking he had lost and woke up to discover he had won. You know, there's the famous 1948 where all the polling agencies predict that Thomas Dewey will win. Newspapers go to press with that headline. And of course, Harry Truman, in fact, won. The case of the 1960 election is one of the closest elections actually in American history. There were a lot of calls for a recount in Illinois, where it was thought that Kennedy operatives had suppressed the vote and that Nixon had probably won. Nixon was asked to call for a recount, and he said, you know, no, that would cause a constitutional crisis. And, you know, and most of us, many of us, will, and Ross will remember the 2000 election, mm-hmm. right, where the projections were led major news networks to call the election wrong twice in the course of the evening. So I think, you know, this the 2016 is distressing for a lot of reasons in terms of the role that polling played. There are lots of reasons to be concerned about what happened that year, in the especially the degree to which different kinds of reporting of public opinion purported to be definitive. So there's a lot more caution this year. News organizations, some news organizations have just said they're not going to make projections, right? American newspapers have been projecting the winner of the election since 1848. And some papers have just said, we're not going to make a projection. We're just not going to call the election. We don't think we could know. And we think calling it could interfere because there's just such a possible mess in the aftermath of the election. So many states don't begin counting mail-in ballots until the day of the election. Many states allow mail-in ballots to be counted if they're received days and many days after election day, so long as they're postmarked in time. There's a lot of room for, if it's a close election, a lot of room for dispute.
And that dispute dispute makes its way to the Supreme Court, where decisions can be turned right. At a moment's notice.
Yeah. Yeah, if you just do the if then of this election, you very quickly get, you can see all kinds of reasons to be concerned. But one of the reasons that the projections this year are not expected to be particularly reliable, and even the day-to-day horse race polling that you're seeing now, is turnout is so high. And so if the people who are turning out who don't ordinarily turn out exactly match demographically the people who do ordinarily turn out, then it doesn't affect the projections. But more likely, people who are turning out are not like ordinary voters, right? In some demographic ways, they're different. And so therefore, the projections, which are based on who ordinarily votes, can't work. And on election day, exit polling can't work because in some places, you know, as much as 50% of the population will have already voted either through mail-in ballots or in early voting before election day. So exit polling is only going to measure the political behavior of people who vote on election day. And since that's disproportionately Republicans, we know that, I guess, Democrats are three times more likely to vote earlier by mail-in ballot. Exit polling is kind of meaningless. So on what other things based on, that's why so many news organizations have said, that is reputable news organizations, we're not going to be making the call. Like, we just won't have enough information to make the call.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jill Lepore, who's a professor of American history at Harvard University, and her new book traces the early days of computers predicting human behavior. It's called If Then. You can join in with your observations about predicting people's behaviors. 800-642-1234. Jill, I want to circle back for a moment to the Kennedy campaign and Simulmatic's work there on the campaign to really have Kennedy take a stronger position on civil rights and to confront anti-Catholicism. How did that play out on Election Day?
Well, the Simulmatic Corporation's reports to the DNC and then to Kennedy offered, you know, four pieces of advice. They were all things that, looking back at it now, and I think even at the time, were kind of political common sense. But Kennedy did do all those things that Simulmatic suggested that the Kennedy campaign do. So when he did win, Ed Greenfield, the president of the company, who was a great businessman, you know, just took credit. He had kind of prearranged a publicity blitz. He arranged to have a big splashy essay in Harper's Magazine called The People Machine. He gave interviews on the radio, you know, taking credit for Kennedy's victory, which annoyed the Kennedy campaign no end, because, among other things, your pollster is not supposed to claim credit for your victory. And the Kennedy campaign had understood this work was, you know, a little shady and should be secret. I mean, there's a memo, you know, that was sent saying, you know, if you're going to use this company, you got to lock this thing away in a basement and throw away the key. Like, nobody can ever know that you asked a computer what your position should be on important issues to the American public. And so the Kennedy campaign engaged in this kind of strategy of denial. Like, at first they were all, oh, we don't even know what this company is. We know what the company is. We didn't really use their advice.
Doesn't exactly help on the testimonial front.
No. But you know, even that publicity was good for Simulmatics, right? So because what Greenfield was hoping to do was to rope in clients. So, you know, big businesses that had products to sell where he could say, you know, you want people to buy your dog food and to switch from the other guy's dog food. We can do that because we convinced voters to vote for Kennedy over Nixon.
So Greenfield and Poole, they take Simulmatics to Vietnam, where they did all these opinion surveys. In 1966, Poole called Vietnam the greatest social science laboratory we have ever had. What were they trying to accomplish in the Saigon countryside?
So something quite different than they had done earlier. In many ways, the company was already falling apart by 1965 when it took that contract, because there really just wasn't enough data available for the kind of commercial work they wanted to do. And, you know, renting computer time was extraordinarily expensive, a kind of cost you can't really pass on to your client very easily without, you know, failing to get new clients. But Poole had a kind of vision for the success of the company, which was to undertake this defense work. He had he was an ardent Cold Warrior. He had done a huge amount of work for the Department of Defense in his capacity, you know, as a political scientist. And the vision of Simulmatics aligned pretty well with that of Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and then Johnson. McNamara had been the CEO of the Ford Motor Company, and he was a systems analyst. He really felt that the way to win the war in Vietnam was by having the fastest and best computers run the data and figure out how to conduct the war, both militarily, but increasingly psychologically, that it was the kind of the proverbial counterinsurgency campaign to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people, the people of South Vietnam. So when Simulmatics and other companies like the Rand Corporation, which had a huge office in Saigon, went to Vietnam to do this work for the Department of Defense, what they were trying to do was what Simulmatics was essentially public opinion surveys of Vietnamese rice farmers in order to figure out, you know, what the best political messages were to inoculate them against communism, which is the larger project, of course, of the whole of the Cold War, right? So much of what we think of as predictive analytics comes out of the larger Cold War project of psychological warfare, that is to sort of figure out how do you stop the spread of communism as a kind of battle of the minds. It's because, you know, we think about the arms race, but people also talk then about the minds race, right? So then you need to understand how people think, and you need to understand what messages will change their opinions about things, and you need to understand how to capture their attention, how to distract them, how to target messages to particular people and change their views. That's psychological warfare, but that's also, you know, modern predictive analytics and mass advertising and pretty much everything that Facebook does or Cambridge Analytica.
Jill Lepore's book, If Then, is the subject of this hour. Do you click on political ads or take surveys online, or are you reluctant to do so because you don't think the campaigns are hungry for data about you? Do you ever wonder why candidates and political parties choose certain topics or stances? Do you think it has anything to do with polling and focus groups? Still time to talk about this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jill Lepore here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Jill Lepore. Her new book is called If Then. That's a nod to the statement to instruct a computer to simulate possible actions and calculate consequences. The Simulmatics Corporation of the 50s and 60s hoped to create this people machine to aid presidential politics. It's an overlooked history to computer predictions, a forerunner to the data crunching we see today out of social networking sites, out of Silicon Valley. So, Jill, you know, I'm wondering, the people machine was the brainchild of a small group of white men and their behaviors, their thinking, their view of the world. Were there women involved in Simulmatics?
There were all the wives of the scientists who are very intimate with the history of the corporation, partly because, I mean, if you think of the kind of family picnic day that a big company has, Simulmatics had a version of that. Much as a very tiny company, but they had sort of summer retreats on Long Island where Ed Greenfield's family had a big, beautiful house. And so all the other sort of major the principals of the company would rent houses nearby, and the wives and the kids would spend the summer together while the men worked on the latest Simulmatics projects. So I was really fascinated by that domestic version of the story, because mainly these are professors, right? That's why they have the summers free to do the work for this company. They're just basically doing consulting work. And the kind of faculty marriage of the 1950s, 1960s, something we kind of know a lot about from, say, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, right? Like the kind of bad bargain of that marriage. The certain kind of intellectual brutality involved in it, the frustration of these generally extremely smart women who are not working as academics. Poole's wife had a PhD. She was quite an impressive psychologist in her own right. And, you know, she did work. But the other wives were, some of them, quite tormented by their husbands. Most of these marriages did not last. And for me, just kind of thinking, I'm sure this is, I see this through the lens of the kind of contemporary politics of Silicon Valley, which has a kind of, you know, we're asked, I think, to kind of kneel before and worship at the great genius of the Elon Musks and Peter Thiels of the world, right? That their genius is inscrutable to us. We're mere mortals before their mastery of these machines. There's quite a lot of that in the 1950s and 1960s with the emergence of computer science, artificial intelligence. The term is coined in 1956 by a group of guys who get together for a summer seminar in Dartmouth. So I'm kind of fascinated by this generation of behavioral scientists, you know, predominantly white male liberals, who are building machines to attempt to deduce and predict human behavior, especially of in this case, Black voters or women who are the chief consumers or the farmers of Vietnam. It's just kind of a weird, the weird hubris and the kind of sexual and racial politics of that, I think, casts a quite long shadow. So I was fascinated to watch that. And the wife of one of the leading scientists, a sociologist named Bill McPhee, nursery school teacher. Yeah, Minnow McPhee. And she was from Colorado, and she was really close to her family. So she wrote letters home like several days a week. She'd write these long, chatty, newsy letters to her mother. So I had this, and her granddaughter had kept all these letters and shared them with me. The family was incredibly generous. So this window from the vantage of the wives and the children of what it was to be married to someone who was trying to deduce the rules of human behavior and program a computer to predict human behavior, but who somehow couldn't understand his own family.
Yeah. Do you think that you give these men too much credit for what they were trying to do? Is their vision overstated? I mean, their company went bankrupt in 1970, 9 years after it went public. It failed.
Oh, yeah. No, it is a tiny, I mean, I take pains to emphasize this again and again and again. It is a tiny, struggling, and ultimately failed company. So the lessons you can learn from it are not the lessons of its that rest on its significance or its great influence. They're the lessons of the parable, the lessons of the allegory, right? Yeah. So you know, an allegory doesn't, it is not enough to be representative of the whole of corporate experience. It's a really unusual story. But the reason that it seemed to me worth telling, in fact, you know, kind of urgently worth telling, it's not kind of my bailiwick really to write about this kind of thing, but it seemed really worth telling to me because it's so important to the mythos of Silicon Valley that it has no past, right? That all these ideas just, you know, sprung out of Elon Musk's head, like, you know, Athena out of the head of Zeus, right? That this sort of self-mystification that's so much a part of how startups sell themselves, right? Like, we invented this brand new thing. No one's ever thought of it before. It comes out of nowhere. We're geniuses. Right? Like, that's, you know, that's a business ploy. Fine. But somehow we're actually almost asked to take that seriously. So for me, it was really meaningful to see Simulmatics as an allegory that illustrates the larger, bigger history that so much of this stuff, the kind of poking and prodding at your brain all day that your phone kind of does, comes out of Cold War psychological warfare. That seems like an important backstory to have when we're struggling so much now with what should be done with these big companies. I mean, there are hearings today. You know, there's a new antitrust suit against Google. We're thinking a lot about disinformation and how difficult it is for Facebook or Twitter or YouTube to reckon with it in advance and run up to this election, and whether they have, whether, you know, why it should come to them to do that reckoning.
We're talking with Jill Lepore, a professor of American history at Harvard, staff writer at The New Yorker, and her latest book looks at the early days of computer predictions, the Simulmatics Corporation in the 50s and 60s. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Jill, you know, what happened to this motley crew, if you will? What happened to the people of Simulmatics, the scientists, after it folded?
Ed Greenfield deteriorates very quickly into alcoholism. His wife died quite tragically and played a part in the dissolution of the company. You know, most of them went on to other quite different things. Ithiel de Sola Poole, who was at MIT, was the subject of a lot of protests by students in the anti-war movement for the work he had done in Vietnam. I think it was extremely painful for him. It was a big reason why the company went bankrupt in 1970. And he moves on to new work. He Poole was quite brilliant, and he was also a kind of an eyewitness to most of the changes in communications technology over the course of the middle decades of the 20th century, and he becomes a kind of prophet of the internet. He writes about and is a huge influence on people who are thinking ahead to when what was ARPANET, the military predecessor of the internet, will become commercial. Mm. And he had been a liberal, he moves to the right, he becomes a neoconservative, and he argues for a kind of libertarian approach to the internet that is it becomes the dominant way in which people are arguing for how the internet is set up in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act. And that Section 230 that people debate about all the time now, that's very much a hotly contested topic. Much of that devolves from Poole's own really important work on thinking about the ethics of communication and communications technologies.
Why were protesters at MIT calling him a criminal?
Partly because Noam Chomsky, who was a kind of national leader of the anti-war movement, who was also at MIT, wrote an essay for the New York Review of Books in 1968 or 69 called The Menace of Liberal Intellectuals, in which he specifically targeted Poole and named Simulmatics as an example of how wrong it was for social scientists to be complicit with the Department of Defense in waging an immoral war. So it just threw a lot of attention at Poole specifically, and even at Simulmatics specifically, at a time when the company basically no longer existed. But Poole and Chomsky had participated in a debate on campus that had gotten very heated. And somehow they just kind of became like the New York Times ran a story about the two of them as, you know, the hawk and the dove at MIT. Somehow the whole of the anti-war movement turned its ferocity on Poole. There are many other people that it could have turned to, but he became the object of that.
Jill, thank you for joining us and for sharing the story.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University, staff writer at The New Yorker, host of the podcast The Last Archive, and author of the new book, If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Just ahead, it is 1 a.m. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.